The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Quite a lot to get to on today's program. For one, we're going to look at the anniversary of the purchase of the G450, the plane that God's work purchased a year ago today. It's hard to believe it's been a year already. We'll look at some of the history of God's work with respect to an aircraft such as the G450. And also look back over this past year at some of the highlights, some of the ways that the work has made use of this new aircraft as well. There's also, if we have time after that, there's also an important piece, I think, about the attack on men, particularly in religion. I mean, we're seeing it really come from every angle in our society, but we'll spend some time on that later on in the program if we have time. If not, then we'll just roll it back to maybe later this week or next week. But I want to start with, we'll just refer you to something that I went through yesterday, this article at the College Fix, it's called, and the title puts it bluntly, "Slutty Sheep, Veteran Academics Warn College Students Are Going Off the Rails." And we talked about how the university campus is just becoming an immoral wasteland, basically, where there's just all kinds of sexual promiscuity. And then at the same time, no, as I said yesterday, no intellectual curiosity. It's becoming profoundly unintellectual, as one scholar or one academic brought out in that piece. I mean, it's just a matter of accumulating stars or pats on the back, but not real education. And then when you put that together with some of these stories, it seems like you see them every month or two, just exposing the ignorance with respect to basic facts of history. Today's Holocaust Remembrance Day, for example, in Israel. I think in the U.S. or in the West, we keep it at different days. But in Israel, it's Holocaust Remembrance Day. And so at the Jerusalem Post, they pointed out, based on recent studies, just how ignorant so many Americans are when it comes to the Holocaust. 41% of Americans don't know what Auschwitz was. They don't know. 41%. Two-thirds of millennials, that's the people between ages 18 and 34, they could not identify what Auschwitz is. They have no idea. They have no idea that this was a death camp, a concentration camp. This article is from the Jerusalem Post. It says the study found that 11% of U.S. adults and over one-fifth of millennials hadn't heard or were not sure if they had heard of the Holocaust, while approximately 6 million Jews were exterminated in the Holocaust. Nearly one-third of all Americans and over 4 in every 10 millennials believed that 2 million Jews or less were killed during the Holocaust. So a lot of them don't even know what it is. And those who do, they don't know many of the facts about this history. It says almost half of U.S. adults and millennials could not name one of the over 40,000 concentration camps and ghettos in Europe during the Holocaust. I mean, they just dotted the continent. And yet so many of our young people, so many of Americans in general, they can't even name one of them. It's just forgotten history. And why is this important? Well, it's important because of what you see coming back. I mean, those old demons are returning. There's a story at Breitbart today, Europe's Jews facing resurgent anti-Semitism, highest level since Second World War. So we're seeing this rise in hatred aimed at Jews. Melanie Phillips, by the way, she has a speech tonight in London. We're going to go see it, some of us. But it's on Jews in Britain and Europe. Is it time for them to leave? Is it time for them to get out before they're persecuted the way that they were in the lead up to World War II? This is forgotten history. I mean, it's history that's repeating itself. And more people, thanks to our educational system, this desert wasteland, more and more people are unaware that it even happened in World War II. As I say, Melanie Phillips, she's spoken before at Armstrong Auditorium. And she'll be speaking tonight in London. Is it time for Jews in Britain and Europe to leave? This is 2018 we're talking about. That Breitbart piece. It says, Jewish communities across Europe are enduring a level of mainstream anti-Semitism not seen since the Second World War. This is according to the European Jewish Congress. It's a chilling message. It's a chilling message that's coming out, and there's lots and lots of reports and studies, just like the one I quoted there from the Jerusalem Post, backing it up. You have the ignorance on the one hand, the ignorance of history, and then the alarming rise in attacks aimed at Jews in Europe. And of course, if you move over to the Middle East, well, bring up that subject on the university campus, and what will most young people tell you? What have they been taught about the peace process, or the so-called two-state solution? Or what are they taught about the Palestinians in Gaza or the West Bank? Look at the most recent flare-up, this march against Israel's border, coming from Gaza, coming from Palestinians in Gaza. I think there have been 32 Palestinians killed so far over the past couple of weeks. And the JP pointed out this morning that 80% of the Palestinians killed were terrorists. They were terrorists. I mean, and it's not even like it's difficult to find this out. The terrorist groups have come forward and said so. But that doesn't matter to the mainstream media types that are out there saying it's Israel who is the aggressor. It's Israel who's aiming to shoot or kill men, women, children, all of them. And these are just terrorists. They're terrorists using their own people as human shields. They're letting their own people get gunned down in order to generate favorable publicity. That's what this is about. That's Hamas sacrificing its children so that it can win favorable publicity from CNN and BBC and the New York Times. This article at the Federalist, it brings out just compare it to any other region of the world. I mean, it's happened elsewhere. Border security breaking down, people, civilians even, spilling across the border. And, people like Erdogan in Turkey that are ordering his troops to gun them down. It's happened just this year. The Federalist says, imagine if tens of thousands of Houthi rebels amassed at the border of Saudi Arabia and tried to cross over from Yemen. That's what Hamas tried to do. What would be Saudi Arabia's response if something like that happened? Or again, what about the Kurdish population? They're in northern Iraq, marching on the Turkish border. How does Erdogan deal with that? How does Erdogan confront that? It says, in both cases, the ensuing firepower would be devastating and the carnage incomprehensible. And so why is Israel supposed to, even as Hamas is pushing up against its border and trying to break in, they're trying to break in through the fence. And Israel's supposed to just lay down its weapons and let them come on in, these hardened terrorists? These terrorists that want to murder Jews? It says, Hamas traffics in the death of civilians, preferably women and children, sometimes real, sometimes staged, always, always to pull the heartstrings of Westerners. They're just so easily duped. I mean, look, they're coming out of institutions, educational institutions, that don't even teach them about the Holocaust or Auschwitz. They've forgotten that history. I mean, this is dangerous. This morning in class, I went through Hosea 4. Read the prophecy for yourself, Hosea 4, verses 6 and 7. They're memory verses. At least verse 6 is, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Because you have rejected knowledge, God says, I will also reject you, that you shall be no priest to me, seeing that you have forgotten the law of God. I'll also forget your children. And then the prophet says in verse 7, as they were increased, so they sinned against me. See, it's because, like I covered earlier this week, it's because of our many sins, our transgressions. We went through that yesterday, I believe. Daniel 8, verses 11 and 12. The sins of the people, so much ignorance. So much ignorance. You're not gonna be in the know unless you're listening to this program or watching The Key of David or visiting thetrumpet.com. You're just not going to know. It's sad. It's shameful what so many of our young people are receiving at their university-level education. The Jerusalem Post, there's an opinion piece. This was just from yesterday about what would happen if 100,000 Palestinians. What if 100,000 marched en masse to the border on the other side, coming from the West Bank, that is? This article talks about how, you know, the Fatah in the West Bank, they're being overshadowed by the noise that Hamas makes. What happens if these two factions come together? If the Palestinian people come together against Israel, and I mean even within Israel, I think there's something like 1.5 million Palestinian citizens of Israel. It talks about twice in the past 2 weeks these well-coordinated and financed operations by Hamas sending these women and children to the Israeli border. Protesting Israel's existence. Well, this opinion writer at the Post says, a mass demonstration that crosses the green line, whether from the West Bank or Gaza, will inevitably lead to significant violence and casualties. The Israeli-Gaza security barrier has been attacked on a daily basis for years with improvised explosive devices, sniper fire, infiltrations of terrorists attempting to kidnap Israeli soldiers, and attempts to build tunnels for terrorist attacks on Israeli civilian communities. That's what's coming from Hamas. And when it comes from the West Bank, well, like the prophecies tell us, half of Jerusalem is going to fall, Zechariah 14. This author says here, what would happen if 50,000 Palestinians and their anti-Israel NGO supporters took over the Temple Mount, the most religiously sensitive piece of real estate on the planet? What if terrorists embedded within the civilians start throwing firebombs onto the Western Wall platform? The conflagration could be the spark that starts the next Middle East war. It says this scenario is not unrealistic. Palestinians last summer stormed the Temple Mount in protest over Israel installing metal detectors. Remember that? I mean, we went through that on the program here. That's all that it took. Israel just propping up one little metal detector. and it led to a small riot. Well, what this author doesn't know, this is not speculation. It's not far-fetched. It's not an unrealistic scenario. In fact, it's prophesied. Half of the city. Read it in Zechariah 14, 1 and 2. Of course, there's a lot of good news in that same passage as well. Jesus Christ returning to the Mount of Olives. That comes later in that same chapter. But we've got to keep our eyes on Jerusalem. And certainly we want to open our eyes and watch what's happening, not just in the Middle East, but in all of Europe. These increasing attacks aimed at Jews. This Breitbart piece, the highest level since World War II. Well, I won't take the time to get into more details there. As I said, we're going to be heading to London this evening to listen to Melanie Phillips and hopefully to record some of the content so that we can maybe play some sound bites for you on tomorrow's program. I'm not sure what the venue is quite like down there where she's speaking, but hopefully we'll get a chance to speak with her as well and to tell her that we're very much connected to Armstrong Auditorium and the work, the headquarters work, coming out from Edmond, Oklahoma. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to send a message or email us, you can send those messages to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
I'm speaking to you from our television studios in Pasadena, where I speak to the world as a voice crying out in the wilderness of modern religious confusion.
Herbert W. Armstrong was the world's leading televangelist and one of the most prominent religious leaders of the 20th century, watched, read, and followed by millions worldwide. But his legacy of Bible-based humanitarianism came under attack after he died. The cabal of leaders who took control of the church he founded, after pledging to follow in his footsteps, methodically destroyed all he had built. Those who would stop them were silenced or excommunicated. This shocking story of betrayal and deception is told in Raising the Ruins. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com.
Now he said, this gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed or preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come.
Don't forget to visit our website at thetrumpet.com. Every day, thetrumpet.com will help you understand your world by analyzing today's headlines under the clear light of Bible prophecy. Log on to thetrumpet.com and sign up for our daily Trumpet Brief email and subscribe to The Trumpet Magazine. The Trumpet Daily.
Over the past few programs, we've been looking at examining the attack on law or on the Constitution in the United States, the lawlessness that's spreading throughout the land, and you see it right at the top tier of government. You see it in the Department of Justice. You see it in the FBI. You see it in media. My father, as I've said this week, I mean, he's written about this. He wrote about it in America Under Attack. He wrote about it in Great Again. He wrote about it just last week in the Trumpet Magazine. Well, it was posted last week on our website. This attack on the supreme law of the land. I mean, Satan was just, having great success during the Obama years. undermining the law, undermining the Constitution, trashing the Constitution. There was a piece this morning, or maybe it was yesterday at the Federalist, about the progressive movement that really got into full swing a little over a century ago. This particular article points out Teddy Roosevelt and then Franklin Roosevelt, or FDR, and of course Woodrow Wilson wedged in between them. And it says how that these three, I mean, they really did attack the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence or the founding fathers' thoughts. It quotes from a couple of speeches. One given, well, let me just read the lead up to. I think there's a quote here from Woodrow Wilson. But as I say, it identifies these three in particular. The Federalist article says, in a speech delivered in 1932, FDR cited progressive-minded presidents Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson as his intellectual inspirations. It says, in this speech, this 1932 speech, he said a statesman's role must evolve over time in order to best serve his people. So a statesman's role today ought to be different than it was during the time of America's founding. It goes on and says, progressives believed restricting government to only protecting citizens' life, liberty, and ability to pursue happiness was simplistic. They believed that as time went on, human beings evolved for the better, thus becoming better at self-governance. Thus, people should not fear the ever-expanding role of government, because modern Americans, whom progressives believe were smarter and more advanced than colonial Americans were, created and devised it. And so then it cites these speeches from these famous progressives, the three I mentioned, and another one, John Dewey in 1935. Again, undermining some of the things that the founders believed and taught and wrote into the Constitution and wrote into the Declaration of Independence. It says here, Wilson went on to say, it quoted part from that. Well, let me just quote from Wilson. This is from a 1923 speech. He said, the Declaration of Independence did not mention the questions of our day. See, is that kind of thinking common today, particularly in the progressive side? Well, look, those documents, they don't really address what we're facing today. And also, I mean, they were put together by slave owners. We're so much better than they were. We know so much more. It says here, it is of no consequence to us unless we can translate its general terms into examples of the present day and substitute them in some vital way for the examples itself it gives. So basically, the Declaration of Independence, it's outdated. I mean, we need something new. Further on in the Federalist here, it says, it's an essay penned, or rather refers to John Dewey and something he wrote in 1935. It says, he argued the founders' appeal to natural law as an eternal concept that has preceded man and will carry on throughout human history is bunk, because their view of liberty was shaped by the society around them, and that society had passed. So what they taught about life, about the pursuit of happiness, about liberty, it doesn't apply to today. Because, well, it was shaped, what they wrote and taught and believed, it was shaped by the society around them, and that society is now gone. The Federalist concludes here, under these three administrations, speaking of T.R., Wilson, and FDR, the office of the presidency expanded drastically, and this shift in thinking, the progressive era ushered in, changed American life forever. These were, in many ways, the founding fathers of the progressive movement. Big government, big socialism, the big nanny state. And that's what we're seeing. A few weeks back, we talked about that monstrous budget, $1.3 trillion. But it's not just, you know, money. It's not just the economy. It's not just big spending government. This thinking that we're progressing, that we're somehow getting better, that human nature, human beings are evolving for the better. If that's true, then you look around society and you would think, well, of course, the conditions, they're just getting better and better and better. But they aren't. And yet they ignore the facts. They won't look at the facts. They have their truth. So many of them, as I said at the start, they don't have an awareness of history. And then when you have all of these cases of anti-Semitism or violence aimed at Jews, I mean, they just won't believe it. Or maybe those who are more honest will believe it, but then say, well, the Jews bring it on themselves. If they'd stop being the aggressor in the Middle East, then people would love them. It's the Jews' fault. It's Israel's fault. There was another piece at the Federalist recently about San Francisco. This rich, wealthy, affluent city, and very much left-wing. But there's a lot of prosperity there, a lot of money, a lot of wealth, because of the boom in technology, Silicon Valley, and so on. And yet it's also a city that's just rife with homelessness. There's hundreds of homeless encampments popping up all over the city. Something like 7,500 homeless in San Francisco. And this article says homelessness has always been a feature of the life of the Golden Gate city, but encampments and the concentrations of used needles, feces, and urine that come with them are new. So it's a big city. It's always had homelessness. But now you have these camps, these encampments, and all of this waste, this filth, this drug paraphernalia. It says dozens of tent camps now line freeway underpasses and sidewalks throughout the city, despite a 2016 ordinance authorizing city officials to clear them out. I mean, it got so bad, the city passed an ordinance that said, hey, we've got to clean things up, but nobody's doing it. Nobody's doing it. They're basically just looking at the very, very worst of these encampments and cracking down on that. But for the most part, they don't have the will to clean it up. And these camps are becoming more and more visible. And the stench and all the other things associated with it. Spreading. Activists, it says, and homeless advocates protested cleaning it up. They went a couple years ago, they tried to clean it up in anticipation of having the Super Bowl in that area. But of course, then come the activists, then come the homeless advocates resisting against it. This isn't fair. Now they're just becoming a permanent feature of the city. It's just a part of San Francisco. You've got to accept it along with everything else. It says here, I heard the problem. Well, this is the author saying he heard the problem was so bad that Target, one of the stores downtown, kept all the tents and the camping gear locked up because there were homeless people coming in and stealing their homes that they were going to prop up in these encampments. But this is what's astounding to me. Further on in the piece, it says, per capita personal income in the city is north of $110,000. And according to a 2016 survey, you aren't considered wealthy in San Francisco until your net worth tops $6 million. In other words, San Francisco is rich and beautiful, and it doesn't care what Republicans think. Like many large U.S. cities, Democrats here preside over a political monoculture. Less than 10% of San Franciscans voted for Donald Trump in 2016. And the city hasn't had a GOP mayor since 1964. So it's a Democratic stronghold. And what's more, quite unlike a number of other big cities in the United States, I mean, they've got money to burn because there's so many wealthy fat cats in the region. Lots and lots of money and lots of problems. Big government that's fully funded, and lots of problems. It says the absence of any organized political opposition combined with its vast wealth makes San Francisco a kind of proof of concept for progressive governance. If there's anywhere progressives should be able to enact their schemes for a perfectly ordered society, it's here. A booming tech industry has made vast new resources available to the city. The 2017-18 municipal budget exceeds $10 billion, nearly a third larger than the budget was a decade ago. City government now spends roughly $11,500 per person every year, more than any other city in the country, including New York, and almost double per capita state spending. Lots of money. I mean, the government there in San Francisco it's spending $11,500 per person. And it says here, that's why the housing and homelessness problems besetting the city open it up to more than mere mockery from conservatives, but substantive criticism of progressive governance writ large. I mean, is progressive government the answer? Is this really a liberal utopia, a progressive utopia? They're getting all their left-wing programs in there. And yet they've got to watch where they walk on the streets, on the sidewalks, because of the human waste. And more of the middle class, they're trying to get out of there because the cost of living is so high. It's skyrocketed. It's just becoming a place for rich people. In some ways, it says, San Francisco is becoming something progressives are supposed to hate, a private club for the super rich. This is something progressives, they decry all the time. I mean, we've got to share the wealth. We've got to spread things out. And here is this private club in San Francisco, these gated communities where the billionaires live. And then the homeless on the streets. This article talks about what they've tried to do just to make it more possible for the middle class to stay there. I mean, they're having to downsize and live in kind of like dormitories where they share bathroom facilities and kitchens and such, communal kitchens, because it's just too expensive to get a house or to own an apartment. You have to be really, really wealthy. It says here, Bay Area progressives find all this troubling because, of course, progressive tech utopias aren't supposed to produce filthy, filthy, drug-ridden, homeless camps. It says, as Arielle Davidson recently chronicled in these pages, day-to-day living in San Francisco now involves navigating incessant petty crime, used needles, and human feces. The public defecation problem has become so intolerable in San Francisco that private citizens have built an online map to track the concentrations of feces in the city so that pedestrians may know to avoid certain areas. A recent visit to downtown San Francisco by a special United Nations envoy on adequate housing made headlines when the envoy compared conditions in the city to what she'd seen in the streets of Mumbai and Mexico City. This is like Mumbai. This is like Mexico City. We're talking about San Francisco. Just a hop, skip, and a jump away from Silicon Valley. All of these campuses for technology, these bubbles. It says, finally, the ubiquitous odor of burning weed in and around homeless camps leaves no question about where the city stands on open marijuana use. Add to that the nonprofit groups that provide access to free needles. And beginning this summer, a handful of private organizations that will open injection sites where homeless drug addicts can shoot up safely. See, they're looking for ways for policies to make drug taking easier. And it's a sanctuary city. So they want to let in the illegal immigrants as well. They want to take in the criminals. They want to allow all of this kind of evil behavior, even as they work to build up their utopian dream. If anywhere these progressive policies would work, you would think. It's in the city of San Francisco, where they've got plenty of money to carry out all of those progressive plans. It just highlights, doesn't it, how utterly incapable man is. How incapable he is of ruling himself. It's exactly the, when you talk about the human heart, it's exactly the opposite of what so many of those founders of the progressive movement believed. The human heart is sick, the prophet Jeremiah said. Jesus himself said it needs to be healed. It needs a physician. Only God and his law and his truth can cure us of this spiritual sickness. And you can't just throw money at a problem and expect it to go away. It's like our founders, America's actual founders, it's like they said, you do away with the religion and the morality. You throw that out the window, and this American experiment, it will be a failure. And we're seeing our society break down. We're seeing our cities break down. We're seeing our families break down. I don't think I'll have time to get to the piece on fatherhood and the attack on men, the relentless attack, the conspiracy against men. Here's San Francisco, this beautiful city. In looking at it geographically, I mean, just looking at the bay and the bridges and all these buildings. And increasingly, these homeless encampments, the filth, the stench, the drug abuse. It's like so many other cities, which is why the UN envoy compared it to Mumbai and Mexico City. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, don't forget you can send those messages to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Fleury's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
Finally, after collecting all the facts, and after a series of divine miracles, the PCG purchased the slightly used 2007 aircraft on April 12th.
That's from our Behind the Work film, a film that we show every year at the annual Feast of Tabernacles in the fall. That was our very own Ryan Malone's voice. He was the narrator on that film. Speaking of the purchase of the G450 1 year ago today, and of course this history, this is something that goes way back before a year ago, even back to the days of Herbert Armstrong. And you look at how much Mr. Armstrong made use of an aircraft. First, the Falcon fan jet that he purchased, I think, back in the late 60s. And then following that, the Gulfstream 2. And then finally receiving delivery on the Gulfstream 3 in August of 1985, just a few months before he died. A few months before Mr. Armstrong died, I mean, he wasn't really even able to use the G3. And of course, those who followed him, they didn't follow in his steps. And very soon into the Takach years, the G3 was sold off. And well, if you've read Raising the Ruins, you know some of that history. They had these big ideas. They were going to save a lot of money. They sold off the G3 and then they bought this big jumbo jet. Well, I guess it wasn't a jumbo jet, but it was like a big commercial airliner that fit all these people. And then the entourage just kept getting bigger and bigger for Mr. Takach. But when it was used for God's work, when it was used for God's apostle, when it was used to take Mr. Armstrong around the world, to visit with the brethren, to visit with world leaders, to visit the projects the church was involved in, what a tool. Speaking of Behind the Work films, if you go back to the last one that played, this was in 1985, the last one that played before Mr. Armstrong died, there was a fairly lengthy section in this two-hour video about the use of aircrafts, particularly the G3, which they had just received a month or two before this Behind the Work film showed in the fall of 1985. This clip I'll play for you. You can hear the narrator, Art Gilmore, talking about comparing the mode of travel in the first century to what it's like today. Here's clip one.
Christ's apostles first preached the gospel to the people of Jerusalem nearly 2,000 years ago. Those first apostles traveled thousands of miles on foot, on horseback, and by sailing boat, preaching the gospel of the kingdom of God throughout the Roman Empire. Today, the message is the same, but the end-time work has a means of transportation that makes it possible to travel more miles in one day than a lifetime of voyaging in the first century.
More miles in one day than a lifetime of voyaging in the first century. A lifetime! That's really remarkable. I mean, it's an obvious point to make in some respects, but it's still worth noting just how far you can get right around the world in one day. I have had some stats here from my nephew, Grant Turgeon, who flies around the world with my father on so many of those trips. But they were in the air for this most recent trip, down under. They visited Australia and the Philippines, as I think most of you know. And then along the way, they had to make stops for refueling or for rest in places like Hawaii and Fiji. And then on the way back, I believe, in Guam, and then again in Hawaii. It was just, I think it was just a little more than a week, this trip. And I forget the mileage on it, but Grant says that they were in the air 44 hours and 15 minutes. And then flying at whatever, 600 miles per hour, I guess it would be, something like that. They were covering a lot of mileage. They were covering a lot of miles. Oh, here it is in his report. 44 hours in the air for a total of 22,164 miles. 22,000 miles covered in just a little more than a week. 7-8 day trip. And 22,000 miles. It's just like the narrator said there in that 1985 film. 1985, he was talking about, well, the first century. It took a lifetime to even get anywhere near that. Perhaps not even close to that. Let me just take you back to, again, this 1985 film. It gave you some of the comparisons there with the first century. And then it talked about Mr. Armstrong, as I say, purchasing the Falcon in the 60s and then the Gulfstream aircrafts after that. Here's a clip two.
The G3 can fly at 85% of the speed of sound, about 637 miles per hour. It can travel nonstop for 4,370 miles at an altitude of 40,000 feet. Cabin pressure is maintained at a comfortable 6,000 feet. With its advanced design and sophisticated equipment, the G3 is considered to be the finest medium-sized jet passenger plane in the world.
That's from the 1985 video behind the work, talking about the G3, and it went on to mention how that Mr. Armstrong received delivery on the plane there in August of 1985, I think 85. I'm looking at another timeline here saying it might have been 1984. In any event, he had it just for a short time, Mr. Armstrong did, before he died. Here's one more clip from that 1985 behind the work, clip three.
And so a powerful new tool began its years of service to the work of God.
A powerful new tool. It talked about receiving delivery on it. It landed, I think, in Big Sandy. Mr. Armstrong was able to board the plane from the Big Sandy campus. And what a tool those planes were over the course of, what would it have been, almost 20 years. 1968 was when he first had a private plane. And Mr. Armstrong at that time, I guess you can do the math, 68, 78, 80, 86. So he's in his 70s. Flying all over the world. Pretty amazing. If you look just back over the past year, as I say, this was the date, April the 12th. This was the date that we received delivery on this Gulfstream G450, touching down in the Oklahoma City airport, where we have a hangar for the aircraft. July 6th, just I guess a month and a half later. After the purchase, my father took his first trip down to Louisiana and Mississippi. He spoke to, I think it was like 110 or 115 people in Meridian, Mississippi. That particular Sabbath, there was a little bit of hiccup a couple weeks later when he was supposed to fly the plane up to Chicago. I won't get into the details of that. But just to carry you through the year, in September, he flew to Oregon for another meeting with brethren, the Feast of Trumpets, and then the big trip to Edstone in October, where he was here for the last half of the Feast of Tabernacles. And then after that, he flew down to Israel, to Tel Aviv, to meet with Dr. Elat Mazar. And it was during that meeting that we received news that the excavation was going forward, that the excavation would start in January. And, of course, later on we learned that she didn't have the funding to kick things off in January, so God's work was able to fund the entire excavation for the first time. That was back in October, that visit to Tel Aviv. In January, there were the public appearance campaigns. One in California, one in Houston, I believe it was, in February. And then, as I say, this most recent trip, from March 27th to April 5th, that took him right around the world, 22,000 miles, just one trip, 22,000 miles. Let me take you back to our Behind the Work film. This is, again, the one in which Ryan Malone is narrating, and this played in the fall of 2017. Here's clip four.
Under Mr. Armstrong, the Worldwide Church of God purchased a series of planes, a Falcon fanjet in 1968, a Gulfstream G2 in 1970, and a Gulfstream G3 in August 1984. Between 1966 and 1986, Mr. Armstrong met hundreds of presidents, prime ministers, legislators, diplomats, educators, businessmen, and other prominent individuals, as well as thousands of church members and youth. By August 1985, he had flown more than 69,000 miles on at least 40 trips abroad in the new plane. This included a trip through Asia with stops in Tokyo, Beijing, Shanghai, Hong Kong, Nepal, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and Bangkok. It also included a European Middle East trip with stops in Bricket Wood in England, Brussels, Paris, Munich, Prague, Damascus, Amman, and Jerusalem, plus visits to church youth camps in Minnesota.
That's just a sampling there of how Mr. Armstrong made use of the aircrafts during his ministry. And then it goes on to discuss how that the Philadelphia Church of God is just following in those same footsteps. Here again is Ryan Malone from the 2017 Behind the Work, clip five.
The Philadelphia Church of God continued in this pattern when it purchased its Gulfstream G450 in April 2017. What Mr. Fleury said might be the last piece of the razing of the ruins. When painted later that month, it was marked with a new registration number, N127RR, indicating the start date of the PCG on December 7th, and indicating in the letters RR, the prophecy of razing the ruins.
That prophecy, of course, is found over in Amos chapter 9. You've heard it before, no doubt. Amos 9 and verse 11, "In that day will I raise up the tabernacle of David that has fallen, and close up the breaches thereof, and I will raise up his ruins, and I will build it as in the days of old." I mean, you think about all of the people who have scoffed. This work, this church, established back in January of 1990. Well, the firing of my father was before that, December 7th, 1989. And then Malachi's message going out for the first time in January 1990. And hear the work now for a full generation through the 90s, through the early 2000s. Now we're into 2018. And look at what God has done. Look at what God has raised up. And all along the way, there have been critics, there have been scoffers, just like there were for Mr. Armstrong, saying, "Oh, well, why are you starting a college? Or why are you breaking ground on an auditorium? Or why would you buy a plane? Or why would you fund an excavation?" God's raising the ruins, that's why. And he's doing it with a much, much smaller group. A much, much smaller group of soldiers, of co-workers, of donors. And yet look at what God is doing. What a testimony to the greatness and to the power and might of Almighty God. Following right in that same tradition, following that same pattern, the fulfillment of a prophecy in Amos 9, one final clip from that 2017 film. Here's clip six.
The purchase was the result of about 2.5 years of shopping and consultation, not just for planes, but for hangar space and regarding ongoing operating costs. Finally, after collecting all the facts and after a series of divine miracles, the PCG purchased the slightly used 2007 aircraft on April 12th.
Delivery of a 930 Delta Charlie.
Congratulations. Enjoy.
Thank you very much. We will. Thank you.
That was Shane Granger working with the company that sold us the plane. Pretty exciting history, recent history for us. But as I say, it goes all the way back to 1968. Well, even before that, Mr. Armstrong, I think, took his first flight on a plane back in the 1940s, and you look at what God has been able to do with this technology to move his servants right around the world. Again, this is not a big shock for people. Air travel, oh wow, I mean, air travel's been around for some time. But what a difference. What a difference. Grant Turgeon and I think Philip Nice together with him, they wrote this in one of our publications a few months ago. It says, the corporate aircraft solves several problems that have limited Mr. Fleury's ability to travel. It allows him to work in privacy and quiet. It also bypasses the need for Mr. Fleury to arrive early at the airport and then all the other things you have to do with that. Its 45,000-foot service ceiling means that it also is able to fly above most rough weather systems. And then it says, but the most valuable commodity a corporate jet offers is time. With the church's new aircraft, Mr. Fleury can drive straight to the private hangar, board the plane, and be in St. Louis in 1 hour instead of 5 or 6. So a pretty exciting day it was a year ago today when that plane flew over the campus in Edmond on its way down to the International Airport in Oklahoma City. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you tomorrow.